Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Zachary Brugman with Pope & Associates in Phoenix, Arizona. This is my first oral argument before the court, and respectfully, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case concerns administrative closure, the longstanding practice that was abruptly ended by a matter of Castro-Tom. The main point of Castro-Tom or the Attorney General's authority in terms of his referral of cases is that we had longstanding precedent of administrative closure through many or multiple BIA decisions, matter of Avetisian, matter of WIU. These cases blessed administrative closure after decades of practice. And while the former Attorney General could have done rulemaking authority and ended the use of administrative closure, the simple fact is that him referring a case to himself, this Castro-Tom, was the decision that ultimately came out was a product of the Attorney General's longstanding views on immigration. And while our brief does focus on that issue, the main point that I want to focus on with my oral argument is just how Castro-Tom was erroneously decided in light of the...
Stop you there. Just ask why. I'm not sure that that issue is properly before us, and I hope you'll address it, because in your opening brief, you focused on the due process argument that you started with, that it was improper for the Attorney General to decide this case himself. And it was not until your reply brief that you, where you mentioned the Fourth Circuit case and presented any substantive challenge to the merits of the rule in Castro-Tom. So we don't ordinarily consider an argument that's not raised till the reply. So why should we consider that argument here?
Well, the first point is that when we're talking about the Attorney General's bias, we believe it's basically a different side of the same coin of Castro-Tom being decided erroneously. That the Attorney General, he interpreted the regulations in an erroneous manner that was a product of bias. And that's especially when we had much prior precedent allowing for administrative closure, as well as decades of practice under both Republican and Democratic administrations allowing for administrative closure. The second point...
But there are two different arguments. I mean, the decision maker was biased or acted improperly in assuming the responsibility of making the decision rather than having someone else make it. It is totally different from, on the merits, the decision is arbitrary and capricious, or contrary to the statute, or invalid. And the your opening brief didn't put the government on notice that they needed to brief that second set of issues, and they didn't.
The reply brief didn't do anything but cite the Fourth Circuit.
And that's what I was going to get into, Your Honors, is that just looking at the timing of our brief in light of the Fourth Circuit and Seventh Circuit decisions. Our opening brief was filed in April of 2019. The Fourth Circuit Zuniga-Romero decision was decided in August of 2019, and then the Seventh Circuit most recently in June. And so our opening brief, when you look at pages...
Well, ordinarily, somebody had to raise the issue to get the decision in the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit. So there was something arcane about the notion that there was an argument to be made.
Well, I believe we raised the issue specifically on page 14 and 15 of our opening brief, where we cite to Avetisian, where we discuss the long history of prosecutorial discretion, which is very similar to administrative closure.
Can I ask another procedural question? If Castro-Tom was not the law, you don't address, would your... client have any chance of getting administrative closure under the standards that are in effect before Castro-Tom? You don't say anything about why he would possibly get administrative closure.
Was prejudiced because he was deprived of the BIA's review of the IJ's denial of administrative closure.
That's fine, but he has to have some kind of a showing. What was the argument for why he should have gotten administrative closure?
Well, I think the main argument is that I personally had seen thousands of immigrants exactly like this respondent who had received administrative closure out of the Phoenix Immigration Court. And
isn't
I'll be perfect.
Ordinarily, when DHS asks for it, when DHS is essentially exercising its prosecutorial discretion.
No. After Avetisian, administrative closure for the purpose of judicial economy was very, it happened all the time in Phoenix. And while the different immigration judges had different views on administrative closure, many cases like this respondent were administratively closed. And I'll be perfectly frank with the court. This particular petitioner, who we refer to usually as the respondent in immigration court, this petitioner does have a DUI on his record. Unlike other cases that we have pending before the court, he does not have a path to relief outside of removal proceedings. And so, to be perfectly frank with the court, this petitioner could have had his case administratively closed when Avetisian was the controlling authority. But once matter of WYU was decided by the board, his shot at administrative closure did diminish. I would point also the court to AR-54. That's where the department gave its position on administrative closure. And we believe that the department in opposing administrative closure at that time made a political statement the assistant chief counsel said that there was a public interest in a final decision. And that language comes not in relation to administrative closure. That language comes from INS versus Abudu, which is specific to motions to reopen. When we're talking about administrative closure and a public interest in a final decision, that assistant chief counsel, his position was very central to the judge's determination in denying administrative closure. But we believe that statement was essentially a statement in line with the administration. And it was a matter of timing where this particular case would have been administratively closed, but for just the time that the motion was requested.
But your argument is that, you know, that there's a due process violation involved in Castro-Tum. I'll say it more generally. But an element of the due process claim is that you were prejudiced. And the immigration judge said you didn't satisfy the Avetisian factors. I mean, he explicitly applied that test. And so in order to show prejudice, it seems like you would have to show, you know, that was somehow an abuse of discretion, such that if we were to make Castro-Tum disappear, like, there might actually be a different outcome under Avetisian. And your brief doesn't present any argument on that. So how could we find, even if we agree with you on all the other elements of the due process claim, how could we find that there was prejudice?
Well, my client was prejudiced by Castro-Tum and by the way the board simply deferred to that case and said Castro-Tum is the law of the land. We're not even going to address administrative closure and review it whatsoever. And so respectfully, Your Honor, I do believe that when you look at the precedent, especially this court's precedent, this court had recognized in Gonzalez-Caraballo versus Sessions, 882 F3D 885, that the governing regulations, the 1003.1D1 little two I's and 1003.10B, that those regulations supported the authority delegated to the IJ and the BIA to administratively close cases. And so this court's
Just to get back to a substantive argument briefly, we understand that. Are you abandoning the argument you have made?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Since we're going to hear the other argument in the next case, it would be more interesting to me to hear you argue what you argued rather than that what you didn't argue. I mean, I think you have a hard row to hoe in terms of demonstrating bias, but there is something peculiar about this whole system. I mean, the fact is that you have something that purports to be adjudicatory, but you have the Attorney General, who isn't really adjudicating as such, acting as the final arbiter, and then you have, in this instance, you know, sort of an evasion of the obvious thing to have done if you wanted to change this, which was to make a regulation. I mean, there's no doubt that he could have had a regulation and said that we're not going to do this anymore. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's where all of the rules concerning deference come in terms of Castro-Tom being just a great departure from many years of precedent and decades of practice. And
the point isn't really bias then. I mean, it's really what hat could he have on? Because if the Attorney General had on his policy-making hat and had issued a regulation saying that we're either not going to have administrative closure or only have in the following circumstances, you couldn't have complained about bias at that point. I mean, that's why what policymakers do. They make policy based on their opinion as to what best policy is, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yeah, we believe the administration had every right to change the enforcement priorities, to put forth new regulations as they've done. But when we're talking about the Attorney General referring a case to himself and using
they do that. I mean, that is the system, right? They refer the case to himself.
Well, this was
a strange case to refer to himself because it already had been decided for that. But he. That's the way the system is set up. So the real question is: there something? I mean, you're arguing with the system, not with the particular application of the system. That's just what I want to clarify.
Well, we believe that in terms of the Attorney General's referral authority, Attorney General Sessions he had the power to at least attempt this, but the way that his background, I guess, really reflects on the way that he interpreted, I guess when you're departing from so much precedent, and you're now saying, well, nothing that was decided in the past mattered. Here's my interpretation, and then you have this history of what our opening brief discusses, and I would also point this court to an answering brief.
I think there's a more interesting argument to be made here about the structural problems than the way you're making it. But let's suppose you had, suppose Senator Sessions, and actually there's a joke behind this, I'll tell you in a minute, but had been, you know that Senator Sessions was, had been nominated to the district court in Alabama before, and wasn't confirmed and ended up running for Senate after that. And so suppose instead the order had been reversed, and after his long Senate career, from which you quote extensively, and maybe even after he was AG, he was appointed to the Ninth Circuit. That means he can't decide anything based, having to do with anything he'd said before?
I think it's a little different when you're talking about the Attorney General being a neutral arbiter of a question, and him referring this
that federal judges aren't neutral arbiters of questions.
Well, I think it's a little different when you're an Attorney General and you're referring the case to yourself, a federal judge.
One of the problems I have is he didn't refer your case to himself, right? I mean, it would be different if you were Castro-Tum, right, saying, you know, he's a biased adjudicator in the case, but he wasn't the adjudicator. In your case, so your argument is even a step removed. You're saying that because he was biased in this other case, we can collaterally attack the precedent he established and have it not applied to my case. And I'm not aware of that being a thing that has happened.
Well, part of the problem of Castro-Tom, and this is it goes to the bias, is that they selected a case that was very hard. Essentially, the respondent never showed up, and so it just strikes at the heart of unfairness that the Attorney General ended this longstanding practice with one case, and the result of that prejudiced my client. The BIA refused to even consider that issue on appeal, and so it was basically impossible to challenge Castro-Tom, and that's where the amicus briefs that the Attorney General requested. I knew from day one that once the Trump administration came into office, that administrative closure was going to go. I didn't know exactly how, but when that amicus brief, was called for, I'm like, oh, this is when administrative closure is going to die. It was just an assumption that there's no way that attorney general, with his longstanding history of bias and killing the bipartisan immigration reform that most people in this country, 80% supported, that he was going to neutrally decide administrative closure, because his goal and our administration's goal currently was to just remove as many people as possible. And that's what they were allowed to do with enforcement priorities and allowed to do with changing regulations, but not changing the law.
What you mean to say, I think, is not changing it, is interpreting the law, not changing it. So in any event, thank you very much for your time, and Ms. Byron.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You're on mute.
Apologies for that. May it please the court, I am Sarah Byram, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General. There is no basis to invalidate matter of Castro-Tom on the single ground petitioner raises in his brief, that the former Attorney General is biased toward non-citizens, has racial animus, and is not an impartial adjudicator. Adjudicators are not biased just because they don't rule in one's favor. Differences in law and policy are not biased. No evidence of bias.
Racial animus is bias.
I didn't hear you. My apologies.
I said racial animus is bias.
Yes, but there's no evidence of that in the face of this decision of matter of Castro-Tom, nor has petitioner in this case pointed to any specific passages, phrases, wording in the decision evidencing as such. And, of course, that is his burden to show.
I'm somewhat more interested, as I said before, in a slightly more structural approach to this, which is the Attorney General is an odd person to identify as an adjudicatory process. Is there another scheme that you can think of that's like this one in the government, where the main policymaking person for the department gets directly involved in an adjudication, which is what this is? He has a route, which is the regulation route, and it sure would have been a lot simpler in this case if he'd done it. But in this instance, if that's what he wanted to do, and I understand it's set up that way, but I've worried about this for many years. It's a very odd system. Is there any other system like it?
Not that immediately comes to my mind, although I would be happy to look further into that, and if I gleam anything, I can certainly inform the court. I would note that certainly he could have done this with regulations. There are proposed regulations that are currently pending.
We're going to hear the argument in the next case. I don't know if you're arguing, but it's not. I mean, that's the whole problem, is he didn't deal with the regulation. There's no doubt, if there's a problem, no doubt he could have done it. So what's peculiar here is that he is essentially posing as a judge, but he's not a judge. Anything like a judge, he's a policy person.
True, but the Attorney General does have, of course, the ability to certify, decisions, as is the way he had done it in this case. And previous attorney generals, and I'm sure will be the case for future attorney generals, have used this ability to issue decisions that perhaps move things in a different direction, maybe procedurally or policy-wise. Certainly, I mean, you have past decisions like Silva-Trevino, for example, or Matter of Compion that look to ineffective assistance of counsel, or Matter of Jean, which touched on the agency's discretion with aliens who had committed crimes in asylum, and they were in asylum proceedings and such. So there are decisions that have been certified in the past, that have more of this adjudicatory nature and really also go to things like policy or the way that the Attorney General wants his delegates to exercise discretion and the things that he can do. So this isn't certainly the first case, and I can't imagine it will be the last to address it in this manner, even though perhaps it could have been done in regulation.
That's why I'm asking a structural question. I mean, the way the system is set up, they'll have a built-in, essentially, and this hasn't been litigated here, and I don't think we can decide, but I'm wondering if there is any case which has looked at this and said, you know, can you have a person sitting around with two hats at the same time? One hat being in some sense, the administration of the immigration system. Although that's not as bad as it used to be, because DHS has much. It used to be all in the Justice Department, and DHS is doing a lot of it now. And the other hat being a supposed judge-like adjudicator. Like a disconnect in terms of a due process system.
I certainly can see that point. I am not aware of any cases that have looked at this idea, about wearing the two hats. But again, I can certainly do more research and look at that. But
there are a number of agencies of the government that have both rulemaking and adjudicatory powers combined. And some of them are multi-member commissions. Some of them are, the CFPB is a single person. And there are other agencies where you have that fusion of powers.
Something less commission-like. It's not like this one person sitting up there doing both things. As I say, it was a lot worse when the whole administrative mechanism was also in the Justice Department, whole INS, but I think part of the reason for separating it out was to have a more independent court, because there has been a lot of calling to make Article One court. Really the kind of thing Mr. Bergman is complaining about here is connected to the structural way this is set up. Anyway, it's interesting musings. I don't think the issue is for us as such. So is there anything else you want to tell us?
I just wanted to briefly add that, as I have said before, that he does challenge Castro-Tum on the basis of racial animus and partiality. There's no evidence for that. He doesn't point to any. And just also to indicate, or to let the court know as well, that my opposing counsel had raised challenges to the agency's adjudication of his client's cancellation of removal and administrative closure. And just to make clear that in his opening brief, he did not challenge the agency's adjudication of his cancellation of removal claim. He also has not raised any challenge to the agency's denial of his administrative closure claim under Matter of Avestian, and so those issues are also not before the court also.
I had a question in that regard, counsel, and that is with regard to petitioner's argument that there was prejudice because, if I understood it correctly, there was prejudice because the board never had the opportunity or undertook the Avestian analysis. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly had the board perhaps done an alternative analysis and looked at it under Matter of Avestian and in addition also ruled the way they did, which was to find it moot, that perhaps would have been more fulfilling. The way that they handled it by relying on Castro-Tum for mootness is correct. There is nothing incorrect about that. Certainly, the board could have also looked at matter of Avestian. They didn't need to, though. And so there is nothing wrong with what the board did in that respect.
And Bergman had raised the issue that's going to be discussed in the next case, substantive validity of Castro-Tum, and the record were otherwise the same as it is here. I presume that if the board did nothing but rely on Castro-Tum and we thought Castro-Tum was improper, that we wouldn't just remand it, wouldn't we? Because we have to review what they decided.
Yes,
and
so
a process claim where we do have to look at prejudice. And so why don't we have to just remand?
Well, our view, of course, is that matter of Castro-Tum is.
I understand that, but if we found
If you found it invalid on the substance or on the merits, then you could send this case back on remand for the board to then adjudicate the administrative closure under a matter of Avestian.
And we'd have to, because they didn't do the alternative ruling, even though none of us can figure out why how he can meet it. They still didn't do it.
Yes, that's correct. So on remand, then the board could look at that and review the IJ's determination that he didn't warrant administrative closure.
Just to be clear, that's your answer. You know, if there were a substantive challenge to the validity of Castro-Tum that had been preserved in this case,
yes,
right, yeah, okay,
yeah.
What about the fact that there isn't one? Actually, it's always a difficult problem. But we have three cases sitting here, right? And we have the next case where there is a frontal substantive attack, and were we to find it invalid there, we would nonetheless let Castro-Tum get applied to Mr. Bergman's client? Or would we just remain that?
Well, you wouldn't have to necessarily remand, because of course he doesn't raise the issue, and so he has waived any challenge to the substance of the merits. I think, however, practically with the court is likely to do would then remand this case, because the board did rely on Castro-Tum to find his claim of administrative closure before the board moot, and then the board would be required to look at his claim, his appeal before the board of that administrative closure under the matter of Avestian standards. There's no indication that he would be granted administrative closure under those standards either, and he hasn't made any argument in his brief that he would. He is removable. He has no relief. So any request for administrative closure for him would simply be open-ended and a request essentially to avoid removal. If there are no further questions, I'll sum up. In sum, petitioner's challenge to the matter of Castro-Tum based solely on bias and partiality must fail. He's also waived any challenge to the legal bases of Castro-Tum and the agency's conclusion that he is statutorily ineligible for cancellation of removal. He also makes no argument regarding his eligibility for administrative closure, even under a matter of Avestian. Therefore, this court should deny the petition for review. Thank you.
Let me just ask one hypothetical question. Attorney General Sessions had even much more definitive statements more often than he did, and he had said things like, in other words, is there no room for a biased analysis here? Suppose he had said, I am absolutely opposed to our having any illegal people who cross the border illegally. I will do everything in my power to see that they don't do so, and that is what I am going to do as Attorney General with every issue that comes before me, no matter what. Suppose he had said that. And then he acts, puts on his adjudicator hat and he claims to be interpreting and regulation.
In that scenario, I think that what the court would first look to, obviously, is the face of the decision, the four corners of the decision, and whether or not that decision itself was facially neutral. And then, you know, certainly they would look at those statements, but they would go back first and foremost to the decision itself to look at the four corners of that decision. Is it facially neutral? Was it the result of an extensive process of review? Was it premised on legitimate purposes? Things of that nature. And I think this is similar to, or that hypothetical, you can look to what happened with the Supreme Court's decision in Trump v. Hawaii with the proclamation and how they looked at and they considered the statements that had been made, the public statements that had been made, but still at bottom said we look to the decision itself and we look to what is in that decision. Is it facially neutral? What is the process that was undertaken to arrive at the conclusion and things like that?
Do you think that the kind of bias challenge contemplated in Judge Berzon's hypothetical, would that challenge have to be brought by someone who was actually a party to the allegedly biased adjudication, or could it be brought by someone else in a later case when that decision is applied as precedent?
Well, our view would be that they would have to be brought by that person itself. That's one of the weaknesses of this case here, is that, you know, even here, Mr. Castro Tum himself has never brought a bias claim. And so, you know, when the standard is personal bias, there's certainly no indication of that personally towards the petitioner in this case. So it would need to be brought by that individual petitioner himself, not someone who's seeking to essentially piggyback off that.
And thank you for very good.
Thank you.
I can offer all questions. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm worried about this. Yes, Mr. Bergman.
I would just note that Castro Tum couldn't challenge it, and that's part of the procedural problem of this case, and why we're asking this court to overturn Castro Tum is the Attorney General selected the Castro Tum because that immigrant had essentially disappeared, and he wasn't going to defend himself, and this case of such national import that ultimately just shows how the process in this referral just is absolutely a product of bias. And when you look at page 17 of our opening brief, we have a footnote 3. It's towards the end of the page. The Attorney General made a statement basically stating that administrative closure, he did not agree with it, that it either should be a removal or a grant of relief. That's it. And so we had prejudgment before Castro Tum was even referred to the Attorney General.
Okay, thank you very much for your arguments. The case Jimenez Garcia versus Barr is submitted, and we'll go to the last case of the day and of the week, Flores Ariel versus Barr. Thank you.